This week on Death of the Reader, our world tour takes us from the man who invented robotics to the man who invented robots, as we delve into Carol Chapek's Tales from Two Pockets. You're listening to Death of the Reader on 2SER. We are Flex and Herds. This is your murder mystery world tour, and Herds, we're doing something a little wacky this time.
Extremely weird. I have never been more weirded out by a novel in my life.
We previously on the show covered famed science fiction author Isaac Asimov with his Caves of Steel. And we are now moving over to a science fiction contemporary of Isaac Asimov, who you might have heard of in the introduction to Asimov's own novel, Carol Chapek.
Carol Chapek,
whose name I continue to butcher.
I don't know what the problem is. Carol Chapek, that's just how it is. That's the name. Don't wear it out, sir. He is a Czechoslovakian author.
Yes.
Yeah.
Now, the problem with Carol Chapek's name is that unless I'm looking at the text in front of me, I keep just saying something different.
I see.
I've gone through Charol Capek. I've gone through Capek Charol. I've gone through Capel Charek. I've gone through Chapel Carrick.
That sounds like a real place.
I know.
Chapel Carrick?
But his name is Carol Chapek.
Chapek, yeah. It's got a little doobie over the sea.
And I'm sure I'm butchering the pronunciation of that because it is Czechoslovakian. And believe it or not, Herds, I am not Czechoslovakian.
I you could have fooled me. Yes, today we're looking at Tales from One Pocket as part of a two-pocket collection written by Carol Chapek. And we'll be looking at the fall of House Wodicki and the disappearance of an actor. There's some sprinkling of some other stories therein because they're all quite lovely.
Yeah, this was two collections of 12 stories each, Tales from One Pocket and Tales from the Other Pocket, which have been compiled into Tales from Two Pockets in their translation, which is the copy that we have here. Now, Carol Chapek typically was a science fiction author, and this foray into mystery was described by one Goodreads user as ill-fated.
That's a bit harsh.
Yeah. Now, I haven't read all of Carol Chapek's other mystery stories, but my understanding from the consensus on various reviews and from delving into this book is that he was a very, very well-read mystery reader.
He had
read everyone.
Yeah.
He knew the rules. So when he came to write his own mysteries, they were so deconstructive that it got in the way of the stories.
Yeah, it's a bit weird in that regard. But yeah, he'd read British and American. He'd written some of his own rules for detective mysteries. And yeah, as I said, it really shows in this collection here. The stories that we read are less murder mystery stories from like beat to beat solving the mystery. They're often about stories that have already resolved themselves. In fact, they almost all are.
Yeah.
The effect that a murder mystery has on the people involved with it. How do the witnesses feel after witnessing the event? How does the murderer feel? What happened to the jail cell they were held in after they've been executed? You know, these sorts of things, these sorts of wacky, at times often supernaturally charged mysteries.
The one thing we did want to address before we pushed on into the mystery context of this was that Carol Chapek is perhaps most noted in modern literature for inventing the word robot.
It's a bit of an overshadowing event.
Now, it's so strange for us having grown up our whole lives with this word as just part of our vocabulary to think that it was such a recent creation.
Yeah. The fact that it was created by a writer rather than like a scientist in a laboratory is crazy to me. But yeah, he came up for it for his book, Rossum's Universal Robots, or RUR.
Yes, let's jump into the fall of House Wodicki, one of the most conventional mystery stories in this collection.
Conventional.
And if you're reading along with us, you'll know that the word conventional is used very loosely there.
It definitely is. Yeah, this story is set, I think it's 500 years, 600 years after the original supposed murder, and it's about essentially historians trying to piece together the past from little like letters and photographs of tombstones and hearsay, trying to put together exactly what's going on. It is archivist Divizek and Detective Captain Docker Majlik, who has lore. He's in the first story of the novel. He's the person who accidentally...
He's the title character of the first story in the novel.
He's basically the protagonist of the whole collection. He solves the case of the safe cracker, but he does it completely by accident, and he has an existential crisis based on it. It's wonderful.
Yeah.
But we see him now, he's an established, you know, detective, which he said he never wanted to be, and this archivist has said, I found notes and hearsay and things that we can put together to make some kind of postification, and I'm going to put it into my book. It's very important.
Archivist Divasek approaches Dr. Majlik, who I'm sure we're mispronouncing that name as well.
It doesn't matter. We love him. Love transcends language barriers. We've established this.
He is writing the history of the reign of King Jiri, and he needs help solving the murder of one of the king's knights.
Yeah.
And the story does this brilliant deconstruction, as many of the stories do, of the process of identifying the culprit in a murder mystery.
Yes,
because
it's so good.
Dr. Majlik only has historical information and vague pieces of context from Archivist Divasek.
Yep.
And he has to solve a murder that happened 500 years ago.
He does a good job of it too, supposedly.
Yeah, and obviously the story plays into a lot of the complications and contradictions that go into finding murder mystery characters. Like, well, this couldn't have happened because of this, but this person could have just lied.
Yeah.
And why did this person do this one thing when this other person could have done another thing?
Yeah, it follows a logical process, one might say.
Yeah, it describes the role of the detective as finding the hypothesis that places all known facts into the most connected, most rational chain of events, which is true. But also makes an excellent point about how absolutely far-fetched this whole procedure is.
Yes, the joke at the end, because that's what this is. This is like a turn the last page, watch the last 5 minutes, like the after credit scene. That's like a, just a, like a stupid Marvel joke. Like it just says, you know. And then the book was published, and the note that the archivist gives.
Of interest is the comment concerning Sir Jezek Skalicky of Skalis, which merits particular attention, but has not thus far been subjected to proper scholarly methodology.
So this entire conversation, despite, and let's be clear here, the archivist, when he walks in, he is the most excited. He's jazzed up. He's trying to get the detective captain excited about this like mystery. And then right at the end, it's thrown out the window.
It's brilliant.
It's so good.
Because it shows you the role of you, the reader, busting in and going, yes, I want to know the truth.
Yeah.
It shows you and the detective going through the process of finding out who it is.
Yes,
and then you get to the end
Getting invested.
Well, it was only because the author chose it to be that way.
Yeah, totally.
It completely undermines my entire position on this show.
It's
I can see why you chose it, Herds.
It's so good. Yeah. I mean, at the end of the day, the like part that sings to me is about like investment.
Mm.
And that's something that builds so solidly throughout the whole story. And yeah, it's just completely subverted. It's perfect.
It's obviously a very fair puzzle. It's extraordinarily fair. It gives you every piece of information you need to know, puts it into order for you.
Yeah.
And, you know, by the time that you're even thinking to yourself, oh, am I meant to be solving it? Dr. Majlik just goes, oh, I know the answer.
Yeah, it's done.
Yeah, it's a bit of a sprint to see if you can get to the answer before the story gets there.
I mean, that's an absolutely apt term to use, a sprint. All of these stories are sprints. They are not marathons. They are not twists and turns over a long period of character development. It's just, here is the puzzle. Go. Bam. Yeah. Explosions. He's taken on a challenge, and I think his original plan was to write a story a day.
Yeah.
But I don't think he managed that. It's a bit more complicated. But yeah, each of these stories, you can see he's trying to look through a very specific set of lenses. It's a very much a challenge he set himself in an author, and I can really dig that.
Yeah. We'll talk coming up a bit later on the show about kind of the origins of this collection of stories and what it meant to Chapek.
Totally.
But I do think that this story, you know, of the ones we've read in the collection, is perhaps the best example of some of the deconstruction that this does.
Yep.
It shows you your role in the stories of murder mystery. It shows you the detective's role. It shows you the author's role. All within like 12 pages. It's fantastic.
Yeah.
And I feel embarrassed for who I am for having read this. And you know what? Sometimes that's a good place to be.
Yeah. Maybe it was all just pointless at the end of the day. Or maybe it was wonderful and we love talking about murder mysteries. Ah, it's so good.
Either way, we're going to be jumping over in the third part of the show to the disappearance of an actor. But right now, Herds, it's time for our guest. You're listening to Death of the Reader on 2SER. We are Flex and Herds, and we'll be back in just a second. This is Flex and Herds bringing you the newest episode of Death of the Reader. We have on board today with us Mr. Alex Simpson, Senior Lecturer in Criminology from the Department of Security Studies and Criminology at Macquarie University. Alex, welcome to the show.
Hello, thank you for having me.
Thank you for joining us. Now, Alex, our author for this week, Mr. Carl Chapek, has a fascination that belies his easy-to-read short story format. He looks to spotlight many different perspectives of crime. Alex, in your experience, how does one's culture play into their perception of crime?
I mean, yeah, it's interesting. I think we have a fascination of crime, and we have a fascination of trying to solve crime and what this means in all these kind of true crime podcasts and dramas. But essentially, what I always tell my students, and I would argue for listeners to view crime as, is a cultural fact. I mean, crime is nothing but kind of arbitrary in its definition, in its application, kind of defined by politics. So as soon as we start to view it as much a political labelling process and a loose set of moral judgments, then we have to see how crime is not just kind of shaped by culture, but also defined by it. So therefore, you know, crime and its definition, when we ask what is it, I mean, purely it depends. It depends upon time, it depends upon space, you know, so what history we're in, what kind of geographical region we're in, but also it depends on power.
Alex, you're joining us all the way from Belgium today, even though you're a local academic here. And we'd like to kind of bring it back home for you, asking how Australians view crime uniquely compared to other cultures around the world, especially, you know, the fabled story of our birth as a prison colony, how those sorts of details in our history play into our interpretations of crime and crime fiction.
Yeah, so obviously there is the historical context to Australia and its kind of modern origin. I think in terms of kind of what crime is within Australia, I mean, it's an interesting one because it kind of imported a set of rules, a set of norms, a set of laws pretty much from the UK out of the book. So it is looking at kind of imposing a set of values upon an Indigenous community, and that kind of completely rewrote the moral judgments upon how we uphold in Australia the rule of law, which kind of sticks much to kind of more kind of Western, North European understandings of kind of crime defined around kind of trying to protect two things really, property and the body, which kind of completely contrasts when you look at much more Indigenous understandings to crime and also punishments predicated much more upon kind of formats of shame which exist in other cultures as well. So there's a historical quirk of it being a penal colony. But I'd always argue what's much more important within Australia is how these kind of values have been imported and imposed in a new way.
And obviously, not every Australian is the same. In the short story collection we're looking at today by Carl Chapek, the stories we're looking at have been written by a historian, a doctor, actors, yep. All these different professions are involved in these crimes. How do these professions, how these various, you know, subcultures and sections of society kind of view that differently?
Yeah, no, I think that's actually really interesting because kind of we kind of view crime as this kind of moral judgment, that kind of, you know, which we are all bound by, which we all have to adhere to. And therefore, we view it as this kind of moralistic element in which we are all equal before it. I guess it kind of ties into what I was saying before about importing a British rule of law. But kind of crime is far from universal. We only have to see kind of the legacy of the financial crisis kind of both here in Australia, but also across the North Atlantic. How many acts took place that were criminal or even that weren't necessarily criminal, but they were definitely harmful, but weren't defined by the rule of law and as a crime, which is what I kind of related to earlier about kind of it depends much about power as anything else. And therefore, kind of crime really kind of targets the same biography time and time again. So for certain people, kind of crime becomes a cultural fact. But this is whom the criminal code is actually targeted actively. So for this group, it's very hard to actually escape this. So when you're talking about professions, kind of doctors, lawyers, actors, even myself as a university lecturer, almost we can study crime as an object, but for other people in different communities, crime becomes something which kind of punishes them, which curtails them, and which they find it very difficult to escape due to kind of power or the socioeconomic conditions as well.
You mentioned in there that a lot of these crimes and the way we experience crime in our daily lives tends to be fairly close to us, you know, fathers, brothers, sons. How can we as outsiders effectively judge the world of crime and make sure that we're not, you know, misrepresenting the things in there.
When I was asked to be on the program, I was asked to kind of talk about cultural criminology. I think this is really where it comes in. I mean, I think it's always important when we're looking at crime, don't view it dispassionately. You know, don't view it through a set of kind of surveys, kind of government records, kind of statistics, which all kind of distant crime as something that happens where that we become victims, for which where the criminal is someone else, is an other. I think kind of view crime as a social fact, as something which, you know, I mean, Durkheim argued that not wanting to go too technical, crime is actually healthy for society because it shows a sense of innovation. It shows a sense of kind of friction, which actually we all need, that kind of creativity to function as a well-run society. It also shows a sense of norms and values which shift over time. You know, we only have to look around kind of criminal attitudes towards kind of marital rape or homosexuality, how these have kind of changed and what we can argue has progressed over time. It's definitely healthy. Therefore, kind of criminal action resistance is a healthy part of society. So therefore, you can argue quite comfortably not all crime is bad. But I definitely argue, look at the experiences, both of victims, but also of offenders. You know, what are the circumstances which put them in that place? I think this is the cultural substance which we all need to think of when we look at kind of crime and criminology, opposed to who broke what rules and why.
I know that you're interested in using ethnographic techniques to explore how crime and crime control is perceived, and finance in particular as well in these sectors. I'd love you to explain to us exactly what ethnography is and how you apply it to your own research.
Yeah, I'm here at a conference, and that is kind of what I'm here to talk about. I mean, ethnography is little more than the study of experience, you know. So it's about, well, how can we understand that? How can we as the researcher put ourselves as close a position or proximity to those who are experiencing this fact than otherwise? Look at surveys. Surveys are just kind of a tool where we study something at a distance. Ethnography seeks to get up close. So, for example, that work has been done by Jennifer Fleetwood looking at kind of female participation in the drug trade with drug mules, and looking at kind of ethnographic study of what's it like to actually be part of that. My ethnography was on finance, so it was very much different, a different kind of circumstance. It was looking at the legitimation of kind of harm. So again, these were acts taking place within the financial industry that weren't criminal, but were definitely harmful. We all know that. So I was kind of in the city of London, back in the UK, and trying to immerse myself within that environment to better understand some of the common assumptions, the rules by which other people played by. And for a little while, to get that small snapshot of understanding, you know, what it's like being you, what it's like being them. I guess this is kind of what ethnography does in short.
What sorts of specific techniques, ethnographic techniques, would you use to perhaps interview someone who's involved in crime, especially when they won't want to open up about their circumstances? What sorts of techniques would you employ there?
Yeah, that's really fascinating. I mean, if you think of a standard interview, I don't know how you're doing this. You go in with your set questions. You might have 10 written out on the page, and you kind of rattle through them one by one. But this isn't a conversation. You're not really given the interviewee the opportunity to kind of show their knowledge and use their knowledge to actually direct what it is that you want to find out. Because in many ways, as a researcher, you're in that field because you don't know. I mean, if you knew, you wouldn't be there. So talking about an ethnographic interview, you're definitely giving a lot more scope to the interviewee to kind of lead what the kind of direction of the interview, to show their knowledge and to really be a kind of co-participator in the research. And what this kind of boils down to is a phrase which I kind of often use, which is, a conversation with a purpose. And when you're looking about kind of talking about sensitive issues, whether it's to be the experiences of being a drug mule or whether it is to working within the finance industry, but what I'm really interested in is kind of basically how harmful your occupational labour is. It's all based upon relationships as well. So you need to kind of get to know them. You need to kind of have a sense of familiarity, a shared sense of understanding, before you kind of get into the tricky questions where you can really kind of unpick experiences around crime. Well, if you go straight in with a $1 million question of kind of what do you do and why do you do it, you know, you're really going to kind of close up. So it's really that kind of softly approach. And going back to the idea, yeah, of this being a conversation with a purpose.
Alex, thank you so much for your time today here on Death of the Reader. It's been an absolute pleasure talking to you, and really fascinating getting to know the world of ethnography and how we view crime with your unique perspective.
Thank you so much for having me.
This is Death of the Reader. We are Flex and Herds, and we'll be back with Carol Chapek's Tales from Two Pockets in just a second. You're listening to Death of the Reader on 2SER. We are Flex and Herds, and we are discussing Tales from Two Pockets by Carol Chapek.
You got it right.
I did get it right.
I'm very happy for you.
This is a little unusual for us. You know, yeah. We have done short story collections before, and I will say again that short story mysteries are a very, very big part of the genre of mystery as a whole.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
You know, not every author is one to write monstrous 300-plus page mysteries with complex plots. And is this sounding familiar to you, Hertz?
Not all of us can be Van Dyne, is what you're saying.
Yes, not all of us can be Van
Dyne. As wonderful as him.
But these always are a really interesting way of exploring particular components of the mystery genre.
Yeah.
We spoke in the earlier part of the show about the fall of House Wodicki and what that means for the role of the detective, the mm-hmm. author, mm-hmm. and the reader. But, you know, all of these different mystery stories tend to come from authors having an idea of how something might happen in a mystery sense, and they explore that one component of the mystery, that's the story.
Yeah, they take one idea and they explore that to its entire being.
In a second, we're going to be talking about The Disappearance of an Actor, which is one mm-hmm. of the other conventional mysteries in this collection, the Tales from One Pocket. But I wanted to quickly talk about the actual origins of the Tales from Two Pockets. The translator of the English edition of this book, Norma Camrada, an American translator.
Hold on now. Bean, Norma Bean Camrada, that is her name, sir. You will not disrespect the Bean.
Is that Bean like Norma quotations Bean?
Yes.
Okay.
So it's like her nickname is Bean. I think it's a gardening thing.
Have we earned that? Have we earned the privilege to refer to Norma Camrada as Bean?
We can call her... We can call...
I've really thrown you a curveball there, haven't I?
We can call her Norma Bean Camrada, but we cannot call her Bean on the urn because that is inappropriate.
Right.
And disrespectful to such a lovely old lady.
It sounds agreeable.
Thank you.
But in her introduction, which fortunately seems to be in every edition of the book that I've managed to find, so you should be able to have a look at it if you get a copy yourself, she mentions that basically this was something that Carol Chapek did as a summer holiday project, essentially.
Yeah, he wanted to essentially think up the idea as he was walking to the post office in the morning and then write them down in the evening when he got home.
Mm.
Which, you know, that's a fun idea, but I feel like that would explode your brain, especially if you're trying to also lead a regular life on top of that. Might be a bit much.
I'm sure there's someone who could do it.
Yeah.
And it seems like it wasn't Carol Chapek. He still got the collection done,
it's
and it's a fantastic collection.
No, it is.
But he wasn't able to do it in 12 days.
Yeah, if only he had the luxury of sitting in his brownstone house and, or you know, tending to his orchids and just, you know, laying back and living large.
Now, Herds, we deal with a very different kind of royal family.
Oh my goodness.
Actors.
Yeah. The ego is dripping through the walls. Yeah, we're dealing with the disappearance of an actor in which a man named Bender goes missing and no one can find him.
Mm-hmm.
And it turns out that he was a homeless man.
I don't as much understand what he's trying to do with the deconstruction in this story.
It's definitely not as easy to follow as the fall of House Wodicki in terms of the mystery either. Like, the process of solving the mystery is watching our protagonist, Dr. Goldberg, talk about it to the killer. It's crazy.
I don't really agree as such. I think that the progression of logic is fairly straightforward.
Oh, fair enough.
The progression goes, well, he's left, no one's seen him. What do we know? Well, he left all his clothes here, so he must have left naked. Or he left in costume because he's an actor.
Look, I could not have picked that. It's only someone incredibly crazy could have picked that.
I don't know. I thought that was the problem that I had with it, though, right? Is that it was one piece of evidence that's just like, oh, yeah, he's dressed differently.
Yeah.
There's just something very peculiar about, you know, comparing this particularly to The Fall of House Wodicki, where it is so openly about the reader, the detective,
yes,
all
yes.
of that. This story is... I guess his corpse looked different. That sure is something mystery writers do.
Yeah, yeah.
It doesn't have as strong of a thesis about the genre as a whole
as some
of the other ones in this collection.
Yeah, I think that definitely as we move towards the midpoint of the full collection of the Two Pockets, we're starting to see a shift in scope.
Mm.
And I think that the point that's more being made is about the quality of an individual and like the power that they can have and that sort of thing. And the twist at the end that Goldberg, you know, he doesn't have any evidence. He outwardly admits, you know, this is a murder mystery. Usually there'd be like a detective just say, aha, I figured out, now we'll catch you. Goldberg says, no, I can't. Like, I can't catch you. I can't, you know, put you down. send you to the gallows, but I cannot do your surgery for you, right? Like, this is a way that I can get back at you. And you'll know, because you need me to, like, look after the people that you love. You know, because I'm around, that you'll feel that guilt forever, which I quite like that as a theme.
Often when we've gotten to some of the end of the stories we've covered on this show, we kind of sat there thinking, like, well, was this ending really satisfying?
Yeah, yeah.
There's been some really strong ones we've covered and some really weak ones we've covered. But I guess that does kind of, this story does kind of address that angle, in that it's a very weird conclusion where he just says, oh yeah, I'll remind you that you're guilty.
Yeah, it is in a sense kind of anticlimactic, but also a very like powerful statement about like the idea of a criminal being caught and sent away, like that very constructed, you know, kind of movie sense of justice that we have is not necessarily accurate to what like real people can get up to. You've reminded me of something.
Oh, yes.
My favorite part of this entire story is when we are presented with the three most important pieces of information to maybe find the killer.
Oh, yes.
And it's that, you know, Bender had a wife living somewhere, whom he obviously didn't care for.
Mm-hmm.
He was keeping some girl in Holosovice, on the outskirts of Prague.
Hold on.
And the third, what?
I just wanted to ask you a question.
What? What is it?
Have you paraphrased either of those two statements?
No, that's word for word.
Okay.
How they are.
Okay,
carry
on.
The third one, I could not read out because it would take me an hour to read. We've got these two, like, very to the point statements, and then the rest of the page is just this entire paragraph. And it's like, gee, I wonder.
What was just the relevant point?
Which of these clues you think is going to come back later?
And
I think it was the first one, probably.
Yeah, and this is one of the strongest points of deconstruction. At least I hope it's one of the strongest points of deconstruction.
And not
because
just
if
silliness.
This isn't a gag,
yes.
I'm very disappointed.
I hope it's intentional, yeah.
I guess one of the other things that this kind of does touch on is the relation between the detective and the culprit.
Sure.
Dr. Goldberg is obviously very close to the person who ends up being the culprit. And what does that mean for solving this crime when they're so close by to mislead you and it just doesn't end up working?
The focus is less on the excitement of solving a mystery that's been long past and that you have no like attachment to, right?
And I think the other final thing I want to touch on in terms of the deconstruction of this story is the finding of the corpse.
Yeah.
Because they find the victim's corpse buried underground in costume. And on the one hand, I understand that it's poking fun at the autopsy and how careless they can be in murder mysteries.
Yep, yep.
But it's also just like almost too silly for me.
It is a bit where they're like, oh, you see, they say it's his teeth were rotten. His teeth were rotten to the core, and so we couldn't bear to look at it. And then he's like, it's like paint, dude. Like this is
it's just makeup.
It's just makeup to make your teeth look like they're rotten. Like we are competent police detectives who are looking into the murder of a very prolific actor. Surely you would check to see if it was makeup. Just touch it. Just like your little finger and just stick it in there. Police, look, you've examined a body before. Come on, guys.
It's really silly. And, you know, obviously, having said that this story's deconstructive thesis isn't as strong, it still has a bunch of very good deconstruction.
It's
in
very
it.
Cool.
It's just less cohesive as a thought
than
the Fall of House Vodicky.
I definitely think that cohesive is the correct word. The first story is written with this very strong build-up, this very strong final sentence that hammers the nail in the coffin. Whereas in this story, we get this is a very personal journey, this doctor trying to find his friend.
Which obviously is much more in touch with typically the way that Carol Čapek does his writing. If you look at the rest of this collection, it, as you said earlier, it's a lot more about the human condition.
Absolutely.
And this story gets closer to that than The Fall of House Vodicky.
That said, he does flick between both of the Dr. Majslik stories. Are very comical, whereas this one is not so.
Yeah.
This one's much more of a drama. I will say I had a plink of excitement when we did have uncovered in the theater, you know, they were talking about the actor and they said, you know, boy, he really liked to be in costume a lot. I was like, oh, less of a fun thrill ride and more of a proper mystery, I would say.
Yeah. So that has been, I guess, Tales from One Pocket.
Yeah, that's the first half of this collection. The stories as we go forward are only going to get more abstract and more weird,
which
is fantastic.
Oh,
I'm so ready. For next week, we'll be looking at The Cactus Thief and An Ordinary Murder.
You know, of all of the stories you could have chosen to cackle after, An Ordinary Murder.
An Ordinary Murder, yes. yeah, no, we'll be looking at those two stories. We might mention some of the other ones. We'll see how we go. But yeah, we'll see you next week, 9 p.m. on Death of the Reader.